Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline at the top of the page is Experts. Defendant Competency, a Rare but Important Judicial Hurdle by Grace Neeland. After the topic of a defendant's mental competency took center stage in a Dubuque murder case, area experts attest it's a rare but crucial consideration in local courtrooms. It's not common, but it happens from time to time, said Dubuque County Attorney Scott Nelson. The whole idea is you need a certain level of mental clarity to be deemed fit to stand trial and really understand a case. Per Iowa code, an individual accused of any crime is considered incompetent to stand trial if the person has a mental disorder that prevents him or her from, quote, appreciating the charge, understanding the proceedings, or assisting effectively in the defense, unquote. If a defendant is found incompetent to stand trial, Nelson explained, the case is stayed, effectively put on pause, until competency can be restored. The issue of a defendant's competency recently came up in the proceedings of Tyler J. Daisy, 28, of Dubuque. Daisy is charged with first-degree murder in the January death of his mother, Jennifer Daisy. An independent evaluator last month found Tyler Daisy incompetent to stand trial, citing concerns over his ability to assist in his own defense. District Court Judge Thomas Bitter subsequently ordered a second evaluation to take place at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville, Iowa. If Daisy is again found incompetent, he will remain at the state-run center for treatment, and his case will be stayed until he can be restored to competency. Daisy is represented by the Dubuque Public Defender's Office, which does not comment on ongoing cases. Zachary Carlisle, communications specialist for the Iowa Department of Corrections, stated in an email to the Telegraph Herald that the current wait time for competency evaluations at the IMCC is 6 to 8 weeks. There are approximately 15 individuals currently awaiting a competency evaluation, Carlisle stated. Dubuque defense attorney Ben Bartles, who is unaffiliated with Daisy's current case, said requests for competency evaluations typically come from a defendant's lawyer, although judges and even prosecutors also can request evaluations if concerns arise. He said such evaluations are rare, however, and findings of incompetency even more so. Over the hundreds and hundreds of clients I've worked with, I've probably only requested a competency evaluation a handful of times, said Bartles, a trial lawyer at Dubuque-based law firm Reynolds & Kenline. Bartles explained that rarity is due in part to the fact that a defendant can have various mental health concerns and still be found competent to stand trial. Evaluations are carried out by psychiatric experts who work with defendants to determine facts such as whether they understand who their lawyer is and what a lawyer's role is, for example, or if they fully grasp the severity of the charges against them. It's not necessarily a difficult bar to clear, Bartles said. When that bar is not cleared, however, it presents a serious challenge. An individual who is not competent cannot assist in forming a defense, Bartles said, making it extremely difficult to dispute evidence against them or explain discrepancies. If we're going to trial, there are moments when I need to be able to turn to my left and look at my client and say, "Did you hear that? How can we explain or dispute that?" Bartles said. And if they are disconnected from reality and can't do that, it's very hard to make sure they get a fair trial. Data shows people with severe mental illnesses also are substantially more likely to be victims of violent crimes than perpetrators. According to U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association, only 3 to 5% of violent acts can be attributed to individuals living with a serious mental illness, a group 10 times more likely to be victims of a violent crime than the general public. When a defendant is found incompetent, the court must evaluate treatment options to restore that individual's competency. The case is stayed, but not dismissed. In many instances, that means an individual will receive treatment at the state's forensic psychiatric hospital, which treats individuals charged with both misdemeanor and felony crimes. Regular updates are provided to the court throughout the process to keep attorneys abreast of when and if the case can resume. Per state law, however, defendants can only be held for a maximum of 18 months. If competency is not restored by that point, the criminal case is dismissed and civil proceedings begin to determine if and for how long the individual should be committed to a full-time psychiatric facility. There, they're treated until they are deemed not a danger to themselves or others, Nelson said. Then this story titled, Iowa Bill Aims to Bolster Pharmacy Reimbursements, by Benjamin Miller. The House passed a bill Tuesday afternoon that requires companies contracted by health insurers to reimburse pharmacies for drug costs, to reimburse pharmacies fully, allows pharmacies to appeal drug prices, and more. The bill, managed by Iowa Representative Shannon Lundgren, Republican of Piasta, aims to prevent companies called pharmacy benefit managers from reimbursing pharmacies less than pharmacies pay to purchase drugs, which has become an increasingly common practice. The bill passed the House 93-3 with bipartisan supporters saying that PBMs shorting pharmacies reimbursements had contributed to the closure of many pharmacies across the state in recent years. We are losing rural pharmacies at an alarming rate, Lundgren said in her closing comments on the House floor Tuesday. At one time, Iowa counties had a minimum of two pharmacies. Now we are down to 54 of 99 counties having at least two pharmacies. Our senior citizens deserve to be able to walk into their pharmacies and speak. Our busy families deserve to be able to walk into a local pharmacy and have their kids tested for strep throat. It's time to take some bold action to stop the unfair treatment of our local pharmacies. By broad strokes, the bill would require PBMs to contract based on a pass-through pricing model, meaning they would fully reimburse pharmacies drug costs and not reimburse pharmacies less than the PBMs charge the insurers that contract with them, which is known as spread pricing. The bill also requires PBMs to create a process by which pharmacies can appeal a maximum allowable cost, which is the lowest cost PBMs tell pharmacies a drug can be purchased for and what PBMs base most drug reimbursements on. An amendment to the bill would also require the state government to develop a digital tool to find the PBM that would provide the best deal for public employees' pharmacy benefits. The bill would also ban PBMs from retaliating against a pharmacy for filing a complaint against them to the Iowa Insurance Division by not renewing its contract with said pharmacy. Iowa Representative John Forbes, Democrat of Des Moines, a retired pharmacist, said the bill was a big step toward protecting especially independent rural pharmacies. These pharmacies want to continue to provide services to their communities, he said, but they are in a state of financial crisis because of the unfair practices that this PBM industry is inflicting on these pharmacies. Business owners are using their personal assets right now to keep their businesses open because they have been so embedded in their communities. You lose your pharmacy, the next thing you lose is a few doctors who think, if my patients have to drive a long way for their drugs, this isn't some place I can stay. It's another stake in small-town rural Iowa. East Central Iowa has been negatively impacted by the local pharmacies in recent years. Widener Pharmacy in Manchester, Iowa, closed last November, citing impacts by PBM practices. Osterhaus Pharmacy in Maquoketa, Iowa, has tangled with Caremark, the PBM subsidiary of CVS Health, and other fees it has charged independent pharmacies, which are competitors with its parent company's pharmacies. Osterhaus Pharmacy could not be reached for comment for this story by deadline Tuesday. Former Widener Pharmacy owner Jonathan Kallenbach is now a pharmacist at Nightingale Pharmacy in Dyersville, Iowa, and voiced support for the bill to the Telegraph Herald. He said the most beneficial measure in the bill would be the appeals process required of PBMs. Maximum allowable costs are supposed to be based on market conditions, the cheapest you could find a product for, he said. But until now, PBMs can tell you the max allowable cost is whatever they want to tell you it is. Per this bill, they would have to tell you what manufacturers they're basing this off of. It would finally be some transparency. That's the part that is fairly important. The measure that has the most potential impact is the one requiring pass-through pricing, according to Dubuque-based Hartig Drugs CEO Charlie Hartig. Their practices have been abusive over the past few years, especially the big three, which are owned by insurance conglomerates, he said. Pharmacies end up being shortchanged, insurers often pay more, no one is opposed to pharmacy benefits manager making a dollar, but no one has been able to see under the hood of the PBMs. Healthcare is very highly regulated, and so is insurance. These PBMs have historically skirted regulation. Hartig said that national PBMs, spread pricing, and other tactics were what inspired his father, Dick, to found the company's MedOne PBM, which generally follows the practices the House bill would require. In a subcommittee earlier this session, Mike Triplett, lobbyist for PBM Express Scripts, a Cigna Healthcare subsidiary, argued against the bill, proposing the legislature instead regulate pharmacy services administrative organizations, which he said were causing more problems in the pharmacy sector. The House bill was supported by healthcare providers and independent pharmacies, but opposed by insurance providers and the national pharmacies owned by the same companies as the major PBMs. The bill now goes to the Senate, where a companion bill never got past a Commerce subcommittee last session, and where, as Lundgren recalled on the House floor Tuesday, similar measures to this year's bill were removed from a 2022 PBM regulation bill that the House passed then. Hartig said he expects similar lobbyist pressure in the Senate as seen in 2022. I think senators are being told that they should oppose this because insurance premiums will go up, he said. But the premiums do not need to go up for spread pricing to be modified. The third story is Dubuque nonprofit launching workforce program this month by Maya Bond. A Dubuque nonprofit's newest program aims to help area residents tackle the question, what did you want to be when you grew up? The St. Vincent de Paul Society Dubuque affiliate begins its latest program, Back to Work, on March 20th, where attendees embark on a 9-day course that teaches them skills to either get a job or get them on track to pursue another career. Cindy Coleman, director of program services for the nonprofit, said the program will teach participants, among other things, soft skills, financial literacy, healthy relationships, computer skills, workplace communication, and how to write a resume. At the end of the course, participants will take part in mock interviews with area employers, and Coleman said some might be offered jobs or internships by employers with openings. Back to Work is intended for the unemployed, the underemployed, or folks who are just seeking something else and aren't sure what to do, what direction to go, she said. The program presents those opportunities. The first session will max out at about 8 to 10 students, she said, but the first round was intentionally kept a bit smaller. The sessions will take place every other month beginning in May. Besides St. Vincent staff, Coleman said multiple area employers are involved in the program and will help with both the mock interviews and some teaching. It will be a host of folks that will come in, and some of them will be the folks that have a job to offer, she said. As the program gets up and running, Coleman said she hopes more employees will join in and it can expand to include sessions for teens as well. Coleman said she wants to learn participants' passions and find ways to help them find jobs that both fulfill their passions and help them make ends meet. We've been on some kind of rotation of this is how it's always been, this is how it's always going to be. Well, why not change that circle? Why not break the cycle of poverty, she said. Dubuque is the 17th St. Vincent affiliate in the U.S. to implement the program, Coleman said, and is one of the smaller markets taking part in the program. Coleman, though, said there is always an abundance of individuals looking to improve their lives, regardless of the size of their community. Greater Dubuque Development Corporation Director of Workforce Programming, Nick Hockenberry, said he is excited to have the program in the area, as well as another nonprofit working toward the same goals as GDDC and Dubuque Works, which is a regional initiative focused on recruitment and skill development of the local workforce. Hockenberry said while hard skills and certifications are important, work readiness and soft skills are equally important to creating a larger pool of individuals prepared to learn on the job and take advantage of upskilling opportunities. Rick Merfeld, executive director of the local St. Vincent affiliate, said the program asked people to consider what they wanted to be when they grew up. A lot of folks that are struggling, who are either underemployed or unemployed, they've either never been asked that question, or it's been so long that they've forgotten how to dream, he said. That's where hope lives, in helping people see beyond our immediate circumstances to what's possible. The program can help participants through the fear and the uncertainty that comes with making major life changes and provide them the support to succeed, he said. Our volunteers have built such a legacy of helping people secure immediate needs that the board and all of us are very excited about leveraging that spirit of achievement to help people take care of their long-term planning and their long-term goals, Merfeld said. A few spots are still open for the upcoming session, and those who are interested can either email backtoworkdbq24@gmail.com or call 563-582-3733 and extension 1 to request an application. Now turning to page 3, the tri-state page, Delaware County children receiving books thanks to Dolly Parton's Imagination Library by Aaron LaBelle. Dateline Hopkinton, Iowa. Delaware County Historical Society board member Jillian Brown announced a new opportunity for Delaware County children recently. After months of work, I'm very proud to announce the launch of Imagination Library of Delaware County. This is a community-powered project, and your support is appreciated. Let's get some books into the hands of Delaware County's children, Brown said. The Delaware County Historical Society has partnered with Dollywood Foundation to bring Dolly Parton's Imagination Library to all children under the age of 5 in Delaware County. One book is mailed each month for free to the homes of registered children in their own name. The first day, 70 kids had registered. The families had already logged on and registered by the time I began. It was a word-of-mouth thing, Brown said. According to the Imagination Library website, Parton was inspired by her father's inability to read and write. She started her Imagination Library in 1995 for the children in her home county. Today, her program spans 5 countries and gifts over 2 million free books each month to children around the world. Brown said the Imagination Library was available where she lived previously and wanted to help make the program available locally. When I lived in California, they had it readily available at the hospital. The Imagination Library was part of the packet at the birth ward, Brown said. Both of my kids have been signed up since birth. When we moved home to Iowa, there weren't any local programs, but it was in Jones, Cedar, and Lynn and in counties, and I began researching how to make it happen here. Brown explained that the books are sent through the mail to each child's mailing address, and the variety of topics in the books provides a wealth of learning opportunities for her kids, who are now 4 and 6 years old. One book had cookies in it, so we made cookies, Brown said. They got interested in Dolly Parton, and I explained that she was a nonprofit and pays for the books. Then we talked about giving back to others, and they wanted to know about the nonprofit. This launched us into the conversation about nonprofits in our area. It was a natural for Brown to pitch a partnership idea to Delaware County Historical Society. The response was overwhelming. It was approved by the whole board. We did the paperwork in November and were cleared for fundraising by Christmas. They're an awesome group of people who have been super supportive, she said. over 260 Delaware County children are registered to receive books. Brown is beyond excited to see the momentum building so quickly. It's surreal that I sat around thinking how to make this happen, and this incredible group of people empowered it to happen. Kids are going to be getting books all over the county. More information can be found on the Imagination Library at Delaware County Facebook page or DCHS website, dchsia.org. Now this story, titled Remains of Dubuque World War II Vet Recovered Decades After Death. The remains of a former Dubuque resident who fought and died during World War II have been recovered and identified nearly 80 years after his death. The body of U.S. Army PFC Raymond U. Schlamp of Dubuque has been accounted for, according to a Tuesday news release from the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. In September of 1944, a 28-year-old Schlamp was assigned to an infantry regiment in Dornant, France, that came under heavy German fire while attempting to secure the area. Many men died in the fight, including Schlamp, the release states. His remains could not be recovered at the time because of intense fighting, the release states, and in 1951, he was declared non-recoverable after several attempts to locate his body. Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency in 2021 was conducting ongoing research into missing soldiers lost in combat in and around Dornant when they located a body at the Lorraine American Cemetery in Limy, France, that was possibly associated with Schlamp. Using anthropological, genomic, and dental analysis, the remains were later positively identified as belonging to Schlamp. His living family was recently briefed on the filings ahead of the public release Tuesday. According to the Telegraph Herald archives, Schlamp had been in the Army for roughly 3 years at the time of his death. In addition to his service in France, he also served overseas in Iceland, England, and Ireland. Schlamp's name is recorded on the walls of the missing at Epinal American Cemetery in Denose, France, along with others still missing from World War II. A rosette will be placed next to his name to indicate he has been accounted for. Next is local historian envisions creating Rockdale Flood Memorial and Park by Andy Piper. As floodwaters exploded out of Catfish Creek's banks in the early evening of July 4, 1876, residents of the town of Rockdale, Iowa, had just settled into their homes after a day of celebrating the centennial anniversary of the United States. A portion of them would not live to see July 5th. Local amateur historian Kyle Cox has a vision for the United States sesquicentennial celebration on July 4, 2026. He envisions people gathering at the site of the flood that left 39 people dead and a town destroyed, to commemorate the opening of a Rockdale Flood Memorial. He needs some help to get it done on time. "I'm a historical nut, but I've never done anything like this before," Cox said. "I'd like to see an ad hoc committee form where we get some people from the historical side, maybe some from the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, some people with a fundraising background." Cox has touched base with the City of Dubuque Planning Department, and his vision is on the radar of Dubuque County Historical Society. The history, he believes, speaks for itself. Rockdale, which was incorporated into Dubuque in 1973, formed along Military Road, one of the first major highways in Iowa. Homes flanked both sides of the road as it snaked through the Catfish Creek Valley and through Key West on its way to Iowa City. A grist mill was built near the creek, near the site of the former neighbor's tap, now Meraki Salon. A dam was built to provide water power to turn the millstones that ground wheat and corn and rye. Another grist mill and dam were built near what is now Swiss Valley Park. Both dams failed on July 4, 1876, when a powerful storm that began in southern Iowa reached Rockdale. Once those dams failed, a wall of water 20 feet high rushed downstream and left the town and its people in shambles. It is my belief that the flood was so catastrophic because those dams gave way, Cox said. Because of Catfish Creek's persistent flooding over the past 148 years, most of the original town is buried under sediment deposited by floodwater. An archaeological dig last summer along the floodplain near Rockdale Road unearthed the tops of some building foundations buried 10 feet underground. It is officially a historical site, but being in a floodplain complicates Cox's plan. He's seeking input on how to proceed with a memorial installation. Cox has invited the Dubuque City Council and the community at large to three upcoming events where he will detail the history of the flood. One event is slated for June 30th, where he will unveil interpretive signs at Swiss Valley Nature Center near the site of the Henry Glade Gristmill and the role that the dam's failure played downstream at Rockdale. It's a really neat idea, and I hope it happens, City Council member Rick Jones said. I think he hopes it happens with city dollars, and we can't meet all the human services needs we have, so it probably isn't going to happen with city dollars. Maybe we can help find a place. He's got a neat dream. The key to it is if he can find some private dollars. Cox said Dubuque is a history-laden city, and the Rockdale flood is a significant event in its history and the history of the state. It's just a great story, Cox said. There is a lot of tragedy, but there is also a lot of heroism. Now we'll have the news in brief column. Dubuque teen sentenced for a pair of school disturbances. A Dubuque teen has been sentenced to 2 years of probation for his involvement in two disturbances at local schools. Ezekiel D.P. Lewis Grayson, 18, recently received the deferred judgment in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County from District Associate Judge Robert Richter after pleading guilty to two counts of unlawful assembly. With a deferred judgment, if probation and payment obligations are successfully completed, the record of the case will be expunged. Court documents state Lewis Grayson was one of two students involved in an October 2022 fight outside Alta Vista campus in Dubuque. Documents state he was also among a group of people who entered Hempstead High School on December 13, 2022. Well, shortly thereafter, documents state, it would not leave the area when asked. Lewis Grayson was initially charged with second-degree burglary in that case, but received a lesser charge as part of a plea deal. Wisconsin DNR warns of high wildfire risk. Wisconsin officials are asking residents statewide to avoid burning this week due to an elevated risk of out-of-control fires. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on Tuesday announced a statewide elevated fire danger notice for today due to windy, dry conditions and warm temperatures. All southwest Wisconsin counties are listed as being at high fire risk, and the public consequently is advised against all burns to minimize the risk of uncontrolled fires. The DNR also is suspending annual burn permits in all DNR protection areas. On windy, dry days, embers from any fire, especially burn piles and campfires, can easily escape control and cause a wildfire if not properly extinguished, the DNR said. The DNR has already responded to over 50 wildfires this week across the state, for a total of 193 responses this year. At this point last year, the department had only responded to 7 wildfires. Updated conditions and reported Wisconsin wildfires can be found online at apps.dnr.wi.gov/wisburn. Cuba City seeks feedback on former nursing home site, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Officials in Cuba City are seeking public feedback on future uses for the site of now-shuttered nursing homes. The city will host a drop-in public feedback session on the matter from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, March 20th at Mound City Bank, 117 West Webster Street. There, community members will have a chance to provide thoughts and recommendations for future development of the former EPI 1 Pavilion site at 808 South Washington Street. The nursing home closed in early 2023, citing increased staffing costs and labor shortages. The city now owns the building and is planning to develop it for future use. and police. The Dubuque Police and Dubuque County Sheriff's Departments reported the following. Kenneth Briggs, 37, of 821 Hawkeye Drive, was arrested at 1:16 a.m. Tuesday in the 2300 block of University Avenue on a charge of operating a vehicle without the owner's consent. Gina McPoland, 27, of 3870 Mount Alpine Street, was arrested at 8:42 p.m. Monday at her residence on a charge of domestic abuse assault with injury. Keegan D. Agan, 38, of 398 Main Street, was arrested at 5:54 p.m. Monday in the 300 block of Hill Street on charges of unlawful possession of a prescription drug, public intoxication, and providing false identification information. And Rio Cameron, 29, of 2845 Central Avenue, was arrested at 3:27 p.m. Monday at his residence on charges of domestic abuse assault, second offense, and second-degree harassment. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, March 13, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Next, we'll turn to today's obituaries. Todd W. Shellhorn, Galena, Illinois. Todd Roundy Shellhorn, 52, of Galena, Illinois, passed away Saturday, March 9, 2024, at his home, surrounded by his loving family. A celebration of life will be held at noon Thursday, March 14, 2024, at the Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena, where friends may call after 10 a.m. until the time of service. The burial will be in Greenwood Cemetery, Galena. Barbara Cook. Barbara Cook, 77, of Dubuque, passed away Thursday, March 7, 2024, at Hawkeye Care Center. Visitation will be from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday, March 16th, at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road, Dubuque, where there will be a memorial service held at 3 p.m. on Saturday. Deacon Bill Biver will officiate. Diane C. Marsh, Galena, Illinois. Diane Carol Marsh, 88, of Galena, Illinois, passed away on February 18, 2024, at Galena Strauss Senior Community. Her loved ones will celebrate her life on March 16, 2024, at 2 p.m. at Grace Episcopal Church, Galena. Friends are welcome to gather at the church from 1 p.m. until the time of the service. She will be laid to rest in the church columbarium. The Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena is assisting the family. Francis A. Brandt, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Francis A. Brandt, 85, of Cuba City, died on Tuesday, March 12, 2024. Visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, March 14th at Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cuba City, and from 10 to 10:45 a.m. Friday, March 15th, at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in Cuba City, where a massive Christian burial will follow at 11 a.m. Burial will take place in St. Peter Cemetery in Elk Grove. John J. Kane, Marshalltown, Iowa. John J. Kane of Marshalltown died on Sunday, March 3, 2024. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 15th, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Gary Owen, where services will follow at 10:30 a.m. Burial will follow in the church cemetery. Rife Funeral Home of Cascade is assisting the family. Nancy L. Spensley. Nancy L. Spensley, 82, of Dubuque, died on Sunday, March 10, 2024. No services will be held. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. And funeral services? Thomas R. Anthony, Greeley, Iowa. Visitation, 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, Tri-State Community Church, Dubuque. Memorial service at 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Stanley W. Backenkeller, Elizabeth, Illinois. Celebration of life, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, March 16th, Woodbine Bend Country Club, Stockton. Craig W. Birkin, Bellevue, Iowa. Vigil, 3:30 p.m., followed by visitation until 7 p.m. today, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Bellevue. Additional visitation, 9 to 10 a.m. Thursday, March 14th, Hockman Meyer Funeral Home, Bellevue. Service, 10:30 a.m. Thursday at the church. Thomas G. Dudek, Dubuque. Service, 10 a.m. today, Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. Rita M. Halfkeimer, Sherrill, Iowa. Visitation, 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 15th, and from 9 to 10:15 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at St. Peter and Paul Catholic Church in Sherrill. Massive Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Terry J. Meyer, Dyersville, Iowa. Visitation 2 to 8 p.m. Sunday, March 17th, and from 9 to 10 a.m. Monday, March 18th, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Massive Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. Monday, St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville. Winston W. Negus, Dubuque. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 14th, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Service 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 15th, St. Joseph Key West Catholic Church. Neil E. Ransford, Dubuque. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, St. John's Lutheran Church. Service 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Stephen J. Schultz, Luxembourg, Iowa. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 14th, from 9 to 9:45 a.m. Friday, March 15th, Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Service 10:30 a.m. Friday, Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Luxembourg. And David F. Schildgren, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 14th, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday, March 15th, St. Clement Catholic Church, Lancaster. Massive Christian burial, 11 a.m. Friday at the church. Betty A. Fishnick. Betty A. Fishnick, 73, of Dubuque, died on Saturday, December 23rd, 2023. A celebration of life will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, March 16th, at American Legion, 1306 Delhi Street. Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper, Westview Funeral Home and Cremation, 2569 John F. Kennedy Road, is assisting the family. James W. Powers, 75, of Dubuque, died on Saturday, March 9, 2024. Visitation will be from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. Monday, April 1st, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, where services will follow. Now turning to the sports page. The story at the top is titled, A Century Ago, 6-on-6 Paved the Way for Girls in Iowa, by Eric Olson. Imagine Iowa star Caitlin Clark playing a basketball game where the rules allowed her just 2 dribbles before she had to pass or shoot, and it was illegal for her to cross the half-court line. For most of the 20th century, this was girls' basketball in Clark's native state of Iowa. The game was 6-on-6, with 3 girls on one side of the court playing defense and 3 girls on the other side playing offense. The rules might seem archaic now, if not blatantly sexist, but it was popular. Girls' high school games filled gyms to capacity in many towns, and state tournament tickets were resold at a premium, with the finals televised in 9 Midwestern states. Sometimes it was so loud in our little gym that we couldn't even hear the coach when we were in a huddle, said Nancy Schmitz, who starred at Elkhorn Kimbleton in the 1960s when her name was Nancy Wolken. It was really dynamic, a lot of screaming and hollering, and we all loved to play. I should have studied more, but I loved to play. Every game in the gym was full. Iowa coach Lisa Bluter, associate head coach Jan Jensen, and assistant Jenny Fitzgerald grew up playing 6-on-6, and Clark regularly gives a nod to her forebears in the sport. When I hear from a lot of people that played basketball, whether it was 6-on-6 however many years ago, I think they're blown away at where women's basketball is now and the platform we get to play on, Clark said. That doesn't come if it's not for the people who came before us. How might Clark have fared with her long-range shooting and nifty passing? Clark has become the face of women's basketball and is among the most popular athletes in the United States. She has averaged 31.9 points per game this season and passed Pete Maravich as the NCAA Division I all-time leading scorer. Jensen, one of the state's all-time high school greats, said Clark would have been just as formidable in the 6-girl game. Those shots from the perimeter and thread-the-needle passes would have been part of her game. Her snaking drives to the basket, not so much because of the 2-dribble limit. She would have probably rewritten all the scoring records, Jensen said. Just scoring and focusing on the shooting aspect, that would have been right up her alley. Iowa high schools now could choose to play 5-on-5 beginning in 1984, but many small schools kept playing 6-on-6 until 1993, only 23 years before Clark's freshman year at Dowling Catholic High in West Des Moines. Chuck Offenberger, a retired Des Moines Register columnist and now an author who writes about Iowa news and culture on offenberger.com, said immigrants from Northern Europe who settled in the state in the 19th century believed strongly in physical fitness for both sexes. Boys and girls worked alongside each other in the farm fields, and basketball was seen as a suitable competitive outlet for all. The caveat was that the sport was considered too strenuous for girls of that era, so special rules were made. Even at that, a federal study on physical education in the 1920s put the kibosh on girls' basketball in areas of the state. The conclusion was that girls should not be involved in interscholastic and competitive athletics because it could affect their birthing capacity in later life, Offenberger said. The larger schools in the larger towns and cities just bought that lock, stock, and barrel, and they ended their programs. In 6-on-6, players on the defensive side did not inbound the ball and bring it up after the opponent made a basket. Instead, the referee would throw the ball to half court, where his partner would give it to the forward to initiate the next sequence play. Games could be fast-paced and high-scoring. Jensen averaged just under 66 points per game as a senior in 1987 at Alcorn Kimbleton, and she went on to become national scoring leader and All-American at Drake. Jensen's grandmother, Dorcas Anderson, was MVP of the 1921 state tournament for Audubon and nicknamed Lottie because she scored a lot of points. In 1926, Irene Silka of Maynard became the first girl to score 100 points in a game. Denise Long of Union Winton was so dominant that she was drafted by the San Francisco Warriors in 1969 as a publicity stunt. Lynn Lorenzen of Ventura set the still-standing national career scoring record in 1987, an astonishing 6,736 points. Schmitz, who lives in Las Vistas, Nebraska, preceded Jensen by 20 years at Elkhorn and played on the 1967 team that was the school's first to reach the state tournament. Her black and orange number 35 jersey, white Converse All-Star canvas high tops, and a scrapbook are among the memorabilia she kept from her playing days. I was disappointed and a little sad when Iowa girls 6-on-6 basketball came to an end, she said. The game had a uniqueness all its own. Many states didn't offer girls' sports until the 1970s. By then, girls' basketball had been ingrained in Iowa's culture for more than half a century, so Schmidt said she and her teammates didn't realize they were ahead of their time. I felt very blessed to have competed during that era, she said, and many of those teammates and I have known each other since grade school and still maintain those friendships and love to reminisce about our days together. Now we'll turn to the Telegraph Herald All-Area Boys Swim Team. This story is titled A Season to Remember by Jim Leitner. The bar has been set awfully high for the Dubuque-Hempstead Boys Swim Program thanks to an unforgettable winter of 2022-23-24. For the first time in program history, the Mustangs won a district championship and qualified for the Iowa State meet in all 11 events. And their 200-yard freestyle relay set a program record and earned All-American consideration while finishing second at state. Rick Leffelholtz, who fronted the Mississippi Valley Conference Mississippi Division coaching staff of the year, landed 8 Hempstead swimmers on the Telegraph Herald All-Area squad, while Dubuque Senior accounted for 5 and Platteville Lancaster 1. Hempstead qualified 20 swims for state, and Senior advanced 10. Here is an alphabetical look at the all-city selections. Brandon Decker, a senior who attends Western Dubuque and swims for Hempstead. Decker swam the second leg on the record-setting 200 freestyle relay that went 124.87 to finish second at state and earn All-American consideration. The first team all MVC Mississippi Division performer also swam the breaststroke leg on the 200 medley relay that finished 14th in 1:38.89 at state. Also at state, he took 19th in the 100 breaststroke in 1:00.49 and 20th in the 50 freestyle at 21:80. Jack Dolphin, a freshman at Hempstead. He swam the backstroke leg on the 200 medley relay that placed 14th at state at 1:38.89. He also took 17th in the 200 individual medley in 2 minutes and placed 30th in the 100 backstroke in 55.69. Duncan Friend, the Wallert sophomore, finished 18th in the 100 breaststroke in 1 minute and swam the 400 freestyle relay that DQ'd at state. He earned second team All-MVC Valley Division. Walter Friend, the Wallert junior, swam the freestyle leg on the 200 medley relay that took 9th at state at 1:36.93. He also swam the second leg on the 15th place 200 free relay that went 1:29.12 and swam on the 400 freestyle relay that DQ'd. He was first team All-MVC Valley Division performer. The Golden Eagles also won a district title in the 200 medley relay. William Fry, the first team All-MVC Valley Division performer, scored points in 3 of his 4 swims at state for senior. The sophomore swam the backstroke leg of the 200 medley relay that went 1:36.93 to place 9th and swam the third leg on the 15th place 200 freestyle relay that went 1:29.12. Individually, he placed 15th in the 100 backstroke in 55.10 and 18th in the 100 butterfly at 52.70. The Rams also won a district title in the 200 medley relay. Michael Rhett Gilbertson, a first-team All-MVC Mississippi Division performer, the Western Dubuque senior who swims for Hempstead, swam the freestyle leg on the 200 medley relay team that placed 14th in 1:38.89. He took 18th in the 500 freestyle in 4:53.23 and 21st in the 200 freestyle at 1:47.10. Gilbertson also qualified for state in the 400 freestyle relay that DQ'd. Zach Higher, an 11th grader at senior, he scored in all 4 of his events at state. He swam the breaststroke leg of the 200 medley relay that went 1:36.93 to place 9th and anchored the 15th place 200 freestyle relay that went 1:29.12. Individually, Higher placed 11th in the 100 breaststroke in 58.80 and 12th in the 100 butterfly in 52.22. He earned first team All-MVC Valley Division. The Rams also won a district title in the 200 medley relay. Jarrett Herber, a first team All-MVC Valley Division performer, the senior 12th grader swam the butterfly leg on the 9th place 200 medley relay that went 1:36.93 and led off the 15th place 200 freestyle relay that went 1:29.12. He finished 28th in the 100 butterfly in 54.63 and 30th in the 50 freestyle in 22.49. The Rams also won a district title in the 200 medley relay. Owen Lightson, the Hempstead junior, swam the third leg on the 200 freestyle relay that finished 2nd at state in All-American consideration of time at 1:24.87. Individually, Lightson took 12th with a 47.85 in the 100 freestyle and 15th in the 200 freestyle at 1:46.41. He made first team All-MVC Mississippi Division. Lightson also qualified for state in the 400 freestyle relay that DQ'd. Mason Lem, the Hempstead junior, swam the butterfly leg of the 200 medley relay that placed 14th at state at 1:38.89. He also took 27th in the 500 freestyle in 22.40 and 30th in the 100 butterfly in 54.66. Kyle Powers, the Wallert junior, led off Hempstead's 200 freestyle relay that finished second at state in an All-American consideration time of 1:24.87. He also scored points with a 10th place time of 47.51 in the 100 freestyle and a 14th place time of 21.80 in the 50 freestyle. The first team All-MBC Mississippi Division performer also qualified for state in the 400 freestyle relay that DQ'd. He accounted for Dubuque's lone individual title at the district meet when he took the 50 freestyle. Zach Wenger, the West Delaware senior, scored team points for Hempstead at state by finishing 14th in the 500 freestyle at 40.50.08. He also took 26th in the 200 individual medley at 1:49.44. Logan Westhoff, a first-team All-MBC Mississippi Division performer, the sophomore anchored Hempstead State's runner-up 200 freestyle relay that went 1:24.87 to earn All-American consideration. He took 19th with a 52.91 in the 100 butterfly and 29th with a 1:49.44 in the 200 freestyle. Westhoff also qualified for state in the 400 freestyle relay that DQ'd. And Titus Wonderland, the Platteville Lancaster senior, made two trips to the podium at the Wisconsin Division II state meet. He shaved 12 seconds off his qualifying time to finish fourth in the 500-yard freestyle with 21.60. In the 100 freestyle, he took 64.64 seconds off his qualifying time to finish third in 47.61. He was the co-ops program's lone state qualifier. And we'll finish with On the Air Today in men's college basketball, St. Joseph versus George Mason, 10:30 a.m. on USA. Florida State versus Virginia Tech at 11 a.m. on ESPN. UCF versus BYU at 11:30 a.m. on ESPN2. Fordham versus VCU at 1 p.m. on USA. Notre Dame versus Wake Forest at 1:30 p.m. ESPN. Xavier versus Butler at 3 p.m. on FS1. Southland Tournament Championship 4 p.m. on ESPN2. LaSalle versus Bonaventure at 4 p.m. on USA. Rutgers versus Maryland at 5:30 p.m. on Peacock. Georgetown versus Providence at 5:30 p.m. on FS1. NC State versus Syracuse at 6 p.m. on ESPN2, St. Louis versus Duquesne, 6:30 p.m. USA, Michigan versus Penn State at 7:30 p.m. on Peacock, DePaul versus Villanova at 8 p.m. on FS1, Cincinnati versus Kansas at 8:30 p.m. on ESPN2, and Big Sky Championship at 10:30 p.m. on ESPN2. In NBA basketball, the Nuggets at Heat, 6:30 p.m. on ESPN. Bulls at the Pacers at 6:30 p.m. on NBCSCHI, and the Lakers at the Kings at 9 p.m. on ESPN. In NHL hockey, the Kings are at the Blues at 6:30 p.m. on TNT, and the Capitals at the Oilers at 9 p.m. on TNT. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.